If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today on this surprisingly chilly Saturday. I thought we were over all that nonsense and had moved on and we're stepping into summer, but I guess we had to have one little last hurrah with that early spring, late winter kind of weather. So we will keep you updated on those temperatures, of course. But we have lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. We're going to be talking a little bit about McDonald's and a program that they have recently put some brakes on because they were maybe aiming at a nutritional approach, but they've decided to not do that so much after some criticism. And then we're going to be talking about the idea of big food, you know, the big food companies that acquire smaller companies, health food companies in particular, kind of what that means when you're a small company and your identity is so wrapped up in being independent, what that means when you have an acquisition like that. And we're going to be talking a little bit about nursing homes. So all of that is coming up today. But right now, I want to talk about Uber, a topic we talk about a lot on this show. And joining us is Micah Maidenberg. She's a reporter at Crain's Chicago. Hi, Micah. Thanks for being with us.
He's a reporter. Hey, Amy.
Mike, are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
There you are. Hi.
Yeah. I was just saying that I definitely have known a few female Micahs, but I'm a male Micah.
Sorry about that. A good friend of mine is indeed a female Micah. Sorry about that. Anyway, Micah, he has written about some Uber drivers who are organizing right now, but without unionizing. So catch us up right now, because it seems like every single day there's a new story going on with Uber and all the inner workings behind the scenes there.
Yeah, it's a fast moving and big story. So in Chicago, in the Chicago area, there's a group of what's it called, them rideshare drivers, folks that typically work and drive under both the Uber and Lyft platforms, as they say, who have formed an association. They're just calling it Drive for Chicago, Drive numerical 4. And you know, the goal is to basically, as John Rice, who's one of their leaders, and some of the folks that I talked to give drivers the proverbial seat at the table make improvements in how, you know, ride sharing, you know, companies like Uber and Lyft operate and work across the region.
Well, it's certainly an interesting topic, and I feel like it's, you know, one we're talking about so much, and there's so many different, different moving pieces to it, really, because, you know, we hear from drivers about, you know, the pay is really not all that it's cracked up to be, and there are conditions that are not favorable. But then you hear, you know, the medallioned taxi drivers who really have very strong opinions and saying, hey, this is really killing the value of the taxi medallion, and this is really changing my work, and I can't do my work as well. And I think every time I'm in a taxi, I feel like I hear about, you know, about Uber, and they're asking me, do you use Uber? Well, they don't know where they're going. And, you know, I think there's so many different pieces to it. And then we have kind of the, you know, recently we had the conversation about Chariot for Women, which is all about, you know, in response to some safety concerns about Uber. So there's so many pieces to it. We're kind of in this really, I think, interesting time with ride sharing in general, just because the competition between the different ride sharing apps are so fierce. And, you know, and so it's certainly no surprise that this group, Drive for Chicago, would start to organize. But what are their main goals, both near and long term, for organizing?
A few things. I mean, I think they're still trying to sort of figure out what their main issues are. You know, that's part of the purpose of forming the association, is to simply identify what are the top, you know, issues. But I can tell you, I think that pay is going to be a big one. You know, a lot of rideshare drivers are, you know, they don't set their own prices. You know, if I start doing Uber or Lyft tomorrow, I don't get to set like the price. You know, the companies do that themselves, and it's up to you as a driver to sort of figure out how to work, when to work, where to work, and so on to make, you know, a reasonable amount of money, or whatever, however you define that. So having clarity on pay is definitely an issue for those folks. Now, like there's some, so there's like the per mile rate that drivers get. That's a
right.
concern. And then there's also things like tipping. You know, if you do Lyft, you can do a tip. You can get tips like from the app. You can't do that from Uber. Some Uber drivers have told me that they do put up little signs in their cars, you know, saying a tip would be appreciated. Some of them have literally Squarespace readers, you know, the little like card readers that you can swipe through to get, you know, drivers that don't have, or excuse me, passengers that don't have cash offer tips that way. So figuring out pay is a big issue, and I suspect that'll be something that the association, this group, will try to bring up. Just real quick, Amy, you asked me about it, you know, sort of the union angle here. I mean, they're calling themselves an association because, you know, we have to remember that rideshare drivers are right now considered independent contractors and can't, you know, try to set up a union under the kind of federal labor laws and rules that go along with it. So one of the things that's really interesting about this organization is that they have some of the things that they're doing sort of seem like the kinds of things like a traditional union would do, but they're sort of outside of that traditional, like, you know, organizing, you know, labor organizing or union organizing like framework, I guess you'd say.
Right. They're outside of the being covered from collective bargaining, indeed.
Exactly.
The exception, though, is Seattle, right? There's an ordinance, I think, that was passed mm-hmm. there that you reference in your story, because there's a bit of a loophole that's been created, or a special exemption that's been created there
Yeah, the city council in Seattle has sort of created its own legal structure, so to speak, where, you know, that's sort of meant to give, you know, ride-sharing drivers in that city an opportunity to unionize perhaps in a little bit more of a traditional sense.
And so what are critics saying to this? I mean, I assume that the aforementioned medallion taxi drivers make up a large majority of those who are not in favor of this organization forming. But who else is generally opposed to this happening, and what are they saying?
Well, I can tell you that, like, there are definitely plenty, you know, I talked to a number of rideshare drivers for the story who, you know, just said, we're doing fine. You know, we like the setup. We have the arrangement works for me. And the pay is, you know, also works for me, and I don't see a reason to join an organization. I know what I'm getting into. I know how much I have to work any given week to sort of make my bills or what have you. I mean, I think like, you know, one of the challenges for this association is sort of getting some degree of scale. I mean, Uber says that on any given month, you know, 30,000 different people around the Chicago area are, you know, using its application to ferry passengers around. How do you get a critical mass of those people to sort of join you? I mean, that's a real logistical and communications and kind of organizing challenge for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we are going to keep turning to you for updates on this because, as we said, it seems like every single day there's a new update to everything that's going on in the ride sharing world. It's very, very interesting. It's an interesting time for it just because it's, mm-hmm. it hit the market so quickly, and then it seemed like, oh, wait, we got to catch the laws up to it, you know. So anyway, we will keep turning to you at Cranes Chicago for more about Uber. Micah Maidenberg, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yes, thanks, Amy. Appreciate it.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about nursing homes. We're going to be talking about food, big food, and the small companies, the healthy ones, and a really interesting effort from McDonald's that has been tabled for now. All that and more on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today, spending some of your Saturday time with us. It is much appreciated. Well, my friends, You know, we don't think often about McDonald's and the word healthy food, the words healthy food anyway. We don't think about that. We think about fast food and maybe the cheat days in our diets. But indeed, McDonald's does. They've, you know, been putting nutritional information and things like that on their menus, and they're trying to offer healthy options, they say, and things like that. But they have quietly ended a controversial program that was making parents and students rather uncomfortable. And here to talk about that with us is our good friend Roberto Ferdman from the Washington Post. Hi, Roberto. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on the program. Well, so talk to us about what's going on with McDonald's, because it seems that they've been trying to push a little bit of a healthy and nutritious kind of agenda on young people, and parents and teachers were not really having it.
Sort of. So basically what happened is that in late 2014, they signed on a man named John Cisna as a brand ambassador. John Cisna is middle-aged. Or former teacher from Iowa who said that he lost a bunch of weight eating only McDonald's over a period of about 6 months. And he made this kind of bootleg documentary that McDonald's then turned into a more professional-looking 20-minute documentary.
It sounds like the opposite of what Morgan Spurlock did in the Supersize Me with this exact same product. He had a very different result, it sounds.
It's pretty much the exact opposite. And in fact, that's how McDonald's pitched it when they sent him around the country. They sent him to communities, but then also to schools. So he would be sent to go speak in auditoriums to not just high school students, but middle school students as well, to talk about this exercise he had undergone where he had lost weight eating only McDonald's, and where he would tell students that what was important was not necessarily what you were eating or where you were eating, rather. You could eat at McDonald's all the time as long as you made good choices when you were there. But the thing is that in the documentary, he also said things like that he ate French fries on most days and he frequently ate Big Macs. And the problem that parents and a lot of teachers saw with this, including many prominent nutritionists, is that the message seemed, while McDonald's argued the message was an important one about the importance of choice in the diet, there was this kind of subtle marketing behind it. They were basically telling kids from a very young and impressionable age that you can eat McDonald's all the time. It's fine. You know, this narrative out there that fast food is what's making this country fat is false. And while the sense is, or while they're okay with McDonald's putting this documentary online as a form of marketing, they didn't want it in schools in front of children. And McDonald's, while they haven't admitted that this is why they stopped the program, they said actually that a story that we ran on the front page last fall that was somewhat critical of the program and efforts by someone named Bettina Elias Siegel, who started a petition that was signed by almost 100,000 people on change.org, weren't what coerced them to stop this program. They said that it was a general evolution of their strategy around their relationship with John Cisna.
It is a really interesting look, right? Because, you know, it's hard to argue with that, right? It is about choices. And a salad is a salad from almost anywhere. And if you're, you know, making a healthy choice, you're making a healthy choice regardless of where the food came from. So that part I get. But indeed, it's the, I think, the muddying of that message that does get a little bit marketing-y. I think especially to young people who I think you need to be really clear with when you're, you know, teaching a new concept, especially when there's so much misinformation out there around something like food choices, right? And so what are they, or is there a countermeasure sort of in place to maybe sort of clean this up a little bit for McDonald's, or a new campaign or something that they seem to be doing in its place?
Well, what they've said in the wake of stopping this program, which by the way, they stopped this program back in November, it turns out. I only learned about this in talks with them recently and over the course of the last about 6 months that they've quietly stopped it without telling anyone. They've shifted John Cisna's role to kind of a community and internal motivational speaker. So he talks about his experience. They're not really showing the documentary in the way that they were. They're certainly not sharing any of these materials at schools or with schools. But I want to point out that it's not just the message that we're sending. They're also pushing this very heavily on classrooms. So he was going and talking at schools, and they were telling these schools that they should show this documentary as part of their nutrition program. and they were giving them teacher's guides. So they were telling them how they should teach it. They were giving them letters from nutritionists that McDonald's has on its payroll that encourage parents to show it to their children. And furthermore, and this is really where it becomes a little bit complicated, and I think some people would find this reprehensible, is McDonald's has deep ties with a lot of these schools because of the way in which it funds various activities. So McDonald's sponsors sports programs, it sponsors tournaments, it gives money to local teachers associations, including one in Maryland that was holding all these documents on their website. So effectively, telling parents that they're effectively endorsing this unknowingly. That's where it's complicated because there's money involved. These schools need the money from McDonald's. So McDonald's goes to them and says, look, but can you please show them this documentary? That seems like an unfair exchange for children who have no say in this exchange. But the short answer to your question is there's not a lot that they're doing to balance out the fact that they've stopped this program. I think that if it were up to them, no one would have found out.
Right. That's certainly what it sounds like. And it is really interesting. And I think reprehensible is the word when it really does seem kind of dirty when it's that deeply into schools and money is tied to it for athletic programs and things like that. Then it gets rather unfair, I think, very quickly. So, well, thank you for bringing us up to date. Everybody, head to WashingtonPost.com to read Roberto Ferdman's story on this and many other topics. Thanks for being with us today, Roberto.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
All right. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, get you to news. And then when we come back, we're going to be talking about small, healthy food companies that have been acquired by big, big food and what that means for their company. Back in just a bit on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us on this weirdly chilly day. I think I heard the words sleet and frost.
You did.
In that weather report. So I'm going to pretend like I did not hear that and keep operating under the assumption that it is mid-May and warm weather is here to stay any minute now.
Monday.
Okay, good. I'm holding you to that. All right, my friends. So, there is a very, very interesting story that is on the NewYorkTimes.com that we had to discuss today because, across the nation, there are tons of Americans that have the ability to live elsewhere and that require some degree of care, either short-term or long-term, but yet due to a whole slew of things, paperwork, rules in long-term care facilities, different programs, all these different things have kind of come together sometimes to create this perfect storm in which people are confined to nursing homes long after perhaps they should or could be, which is a really scary thought, especially as we think of our own loved ones. And so here to talk about that is Sherry Fink, who is a New York Times correspondent and author of 5 Days at Memorial. Hi, Sherry. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Thanks for talking about this issue.
Well, it is really a chilling story. And, we don't think about these kind of things here, nearly 20 years after the Supreme Court ruled that we have the right to live in our own community and we have, the right to determine our own care. This seems a very, it seems like the reality has not caught up with the law.
It's true. That Supreme Court decision, which was known as the Olmstead decision, was really based on the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they interpreted that quite broadly. So this could be people who are, any of us, if we're getting older, or people with various disabilities, people with mental illness, which, at some point in people's lives, it's quite common. And the idea is that the, public support for things, Medicaid, let's say, which would pay for a nursing home, that should be rebalanced, that money should be shifted toward supporting people to live in the community if that's their choice. And here we are, as you said, 20 years after that, and we found people across the country who were just stuck for a variety of reasons in these institutions where they didn't want to be and where they didn't have to be.
Which is really so terrifying when we, you know, think of our own families and people in our families who, you know, either through illness or injury or age or whatever, have been in such a situation. And so the numbers here that we're looking at, as you report them, we're looking at about 1.4 million Americans who have the need, who are in some sort of care situation like this. But it's looking perhaps like about 155,000 of those people could live outside of those facilities quite easily and have the support or means to do so.
Yes. In fact, we had people argue to us that that number could be much higher. So you can look at that number, the proportion of the people in nursing homes in all sorts of ways. And the lead at the Department of Justice, Eve Hill, who has been basically trying to bring some cases against states that aren't shifting the money, that aren't facilitating services in the community for people who need them, she was almost loath to say that there was anybody who couldn't live in the community without appropriate support. So, you know, in her mind, that number would be far more than 150,000. But the way that it's been cut up by researchers and economists could be, you could look at, well, what are the number of people who are under age 65 in nursing homes? That could be one group that you could target to live in, you know, good chance of living well in the community, or people who have low care needs, who aren't requiring round the clock nursing care. So there are different ways you can cut that statistic, but some people would argue that with the right support, a very high proportion of the people in nursing homes could live in, quote, less restrictive settings. So whether that be adult foster care or back in the home with a lot of, you know, caregiving assistance. Some states are even allowing family members to be paid for the care that they give.
It's very, very interesting. And as we think of, you know, I think a lot of us think of nursing home and we think of, you know, where, you know, grandma or grandpa spent the last years of their lives. But in your story there were some people that you spoke to their stories were so horrifying. One, a 32-year-old single father entered a nursing home for rehab after a leg amputation and had trouble getting out of that. Once he was healed and ready to go back and take care of his son, look for an apartment, do those things, he couldn't get out of that. And a 53-year-old who experienced paralysis, 11 years to get out of that situation. So we're not talking about you know, a frustrating thing where, you know, I mean, I think of my own parents and my dad, you know, who's been in the hospital a few times just saying, get me the heck out of here. I don't want to be here anymore. We're not talking about that. We're talking about lengthy, very frustrating, and I'm sure quite costly battles to move back to your own community.
That's right. And it's actually both groups. So if you poll people, the majority of people would prefer to be in communities rather than in nursing homes. That's like a very, very broad finding. And that could be older people or younger people. And I think we chose some of these really, you know, very stark stories because they really make the point. But there are plenty of programs to help older people stay at home with a lot more support, you know, than just living at home and kind of getting by and not being terribly safe. But in these cases, one of the key dynamics is that, and something I didn't know going into this, is that when you go into a nursing home, if very few people have insurance plans that will cover. So how many of us actually invest in long-term care insurance? It's a relatively small number. So short-term, yes, your insurance may cover rehab, Medicare may cover rehab, but if you get beyond a certain number of days, you are paying for that nursing home out of your pocket, or once you, quote, spend down, it's going to be Medicaid. And in that case, even if you're getting Social Security, for example, your Social Security payments will go automatically to that nursing home, and you get $50 a month. So try to imagine keeping up your home payments, your mortgage, your car payments, while the vast majority, almost all of your income, whatever it is going for that nursing home. It's impossible. And so you get these stories of people just losing everything on the outside, and when they're ready to move home, they have nothing. They can't do it. They need help to get housing, get affordable housing, and that seems to be what holds people up for many years.
absolutely chilling and horrifying, these things that you're saying right now. So how do we shore this up, and who is working on fixing this?
So I think the key groups that we learned about, well, first of all, the Department of Justice has seemed to make this a priority, and you can go on, if you Google Olmstead Enforcement, Olmstead Enforcement, you can find a variety of their actions. And if you go to nytimes.com and look at our story, pardon me, I think we have links. But then there are groups like Councils on Independent Living. There are, legal organizations that try to help people who are trapped in this kind of bureaucratic nightmare, in some cases even fighting to get the right type of assistance at home. And it varies so much state by state. And you can see Illinois, for example, has had a number of lawsuits based on the Supreme Court decision. And there are currently efforts to move people who want to be out of nursing homes out of the nursing homes as part of the settlement of some of those cases. So there are a lot of resources out there, but it is still a hard fight for people to get out.
Fascinating story. Thank you so much for joining us today. Everybody, head to newyorktimes.com and read this story. It's called Confined to Nursing Homes, But Longing and Ready for Home. It is fascinating and eye-opening, and I think it is super important that we talk about this and think about this and do work to help the law catch up with the reality and vice versa, help it all work together the way it should. So Sherry Fink, thank you so much for being with us, New York Times correspondent and author of 5 Days at Memorial.
Thank you.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break, and we come back. We are talking about those small health food companies that are so mission-driven. What happens when they get acquired by big food? We're going to talk about it when we come back on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us on this weirdly chilly Saturday. But I have it on good authority. It's going to warm up by Monday and maybe stay warm. We can actually get our summer on. It's going to be all good, my friends. All right. So, you know, we all have those, we want to eat healthy. We want to buy products that are good for our skin and not full of chemicals and things like that. And we worry about all the chemicals in our environments. I know I certainly do. And I try to have natural products to clean my house and all those kind of things. But what happens, especially when we're talking about health food companies, those smaller companies, when they get acquired by big food, right? When those big companies take over the little guy, what does that mean? All those things. There's a lot of questions that it brings up. And here to talk with us now about that is Greg Trotter from Chicago Tribune. Hi, Greg. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us today. Well, so talk to us about this, because we keep hearing, health food is on the rise. It's getting, we know it's easier to get access to healthy food. You know, we have big stores like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's that make it a little bit easier to buy organic and healthier foods than it used to be. But there's a lot of, complicating and interesting factors to that you've recently written about. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what we're seeing is there's a lot more large food manufacturers, big companies like Mondelez, General Mills, Kellogg's. You can think of really any big food manufacturer, and they're all looking at acquiring these smaller food companies that are in the organic, natural, kind of better for you food space that's growing. And these companies, they see the writing on the wall when it comes to what consumers want, and it's really been a pretty monumental shift in consumer demand over the last 5-10 years, that people increasingly are looking for these foods. They want cleaner labels. They want it sustainably sourced. There's a lot of different things that sort of fall under this umbrella of what people are looking for. But they're these small companies that have built up trust, and they've built up a name for themselves, and it's a lot easier for these large food manufacturers to come in and buy them, essentially, as opposed to creating these brands and competing with them. So we're seeing a lot more of that. That's been going on for the past 10 years or so, but it's picking up pace, and food companies are doing it in different ways now, too. It's not just through traditional mergers and acquisitions. It's companies like General Mills and Campbell Soup have venture capital funds that are now investing in food startups when they're still small. And that's not necessarily even to acquire them, although that's certainly a possibility, but it's also just to kind of keep a finger on the pulse of food trends. So you have these kind of traditionally stodgy food companies trying to change with the times.
Right. And, you know, one that you mentioned in your story at ChicagoTribune.com that I found eye-opening and didn't realize was ConAgra with Alexia, the frozen, you know, the frozen sweet potato fries, things like that. We think we're making this really great choice because Alexia talks so much about, you know, their organic and non-GMO and all that. And then, but I think there is some degree of, you know, consumer mistrust sometimes with these big companies that we hear about so much, like ConAgra and those guys. We think of them as this kind of monolith that we don't know what happens on the other side. And whereas I think there's a perception with these smaller companies that they want to be very transparent. They want to tell us what's in the food and who grew it and how it comes together and all that. So you mention in your story that there are some companies, I think Annie's Organics is one that you mentioned, that still operates completely separate and functions independently from, you know, the larger parent company. But often that's not the case. Often it seems like there's, you know, it's a mixed bag as to how that corporate marriage is going to work, really, whether it's going to stay independent or if it's going to be kind of, you know, absorbed by the larger company, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, there's a variety of approaches for sure. Yeah, I think a lot of the big companies are, you know, they realize that consumers may not trust their name for whatever reason. And so they want to, and it's one reason why they want to keep these, when they do make these acquisitions, they want to keep them as independent as possible. So General Mills bought Annie's Organic, which is known for its, you know, the bunny shaped organic mac and cheese that's everywhere now. They bought them in 2014 for $820 million. And they pretty much just left them in Berkeley. And, you know, so Annie's is still making their own decisions. It's its own company. And, you know, but they're, you know, boosting it with this huge distribution network and these resources that Annie's never had before. And so sales are growing double digits. And they're, you know, going off into other categories like cereal and yogurt and places they weren't before. So that's sort of the idea is you keep these companies independent. You give them resources, you help them grow, but it's a tough balance. And so I think that, you know, companies are still trying to sort it out. And the other example in the story, a local example, is Enjoy Life Foods, which is, you know, sort of widely regarded as basically, you know, creating this free from food category. Their food is free from the 8 common allergens, all gluten-free. They were bought by Mondelez last year, Mondelez International, which is known for making Oreos and Ritz crackers and things like that. But similarly, the Mondelez is saying, look, we want Enjoy Life to be its own thing, a wholly owned subsidiary, makes its own decisions. But now Enjoy Life has capital it never had before, and it's about to move into a 200,000 square foot facility in Indiana, moving production out of its plants in Schiller Park. And that's something that they never would have been able to do without being bought by Mondelez.
Right, without that support. It is an interesting balance, right? You know, I think we all kind of root for the little guys and we want them to, and especially if it's a brand we love and trust, we want them to win. But to do that, they need that backing and they need that access to their distributorship network and all those things that a large company can offer. I think I think the narrative kind of splits a little bit, though, with a couple things. One of them is I think people are starting to realize that the putting a green leaf or something and saying the word natural on packaging doesn't really mean much, although I think we all kind of can fall for that. Sometimes it can be the identical product next to each other, but one has like a brown label and a leaf on it. So we think we're doing the right thing, but it's really the same thing because that's not regulated. There's that. But I think when we start talking about allergens and things that people, you know, especially things that can literally kill people with a food allergy or certainly make them uncomfortable with a food allergy, you know, I think that's when I think it gets a little different, because if we're buying a product because we, you know, have to have a completely, say, you know, peanut-free environment that our food is made in because someone in the household has a really severe peanut allergy, but suddenly they're acquired, I think some transparency is probably needed because you still want that peace of mind that you're giving your family or yourself, you know, food that's not going to put you in peril.
Right. No, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, and the Enjoy Life CEO, Scott Mandel, says, look, you know, we're not going to change. Our brand promise is not going to change. We're still going to be free from these eight things, the eight common allergens. And I mean, that's their whole, what their whole business is predicated on, is that, you know, it's not just a trend, that there are people out there with serious food allergies that want to be able to have cookies and, you know, baking chocolate and their other products that, and feel safe about it. So they have sort of this built-in group of core consumers there that aren't going to go away. And, you know, I think that, you know, analysts that are looking at this as well are thinking that this is a pretty low risk acquisition for Mondelez, because as long as you don't mess with that, then, you know, it's not, then you're good. I mean, it would have to be, it would be, you know, do something really dumb to mess that up. It's a pretty low risk deal. You just have to, you know, keep it free from. But the other point you made is, you know, you're right. I mean, the word natural doesn't mean anything. And the FDA announced earlier this week that they're going to be, you know, doing a big review to you know, in terms of what they consider to be healthy. So I think there is a sense that there is a lot of sort of marketing shenanigans going on, and that maybe, you know, the food labeling and FDA's a little bit has some catch up to do. And, you know, if you're a consumer out there, you just have to sort of do your homework and figure out what matters to you and, you know, see if what you're buying aligns with your values.
Indeed. Well, we will keep turning to you to keep us updated on all those marketing shenanigans. So thanks so much for being with us today. Everybody, head to chicagotribune.com to read Greg Trotter's story, As Tastes Shift, Big Food Devours Smaller Health-Focused Companies. So check that out and read all about it and see these examples of the companies and brands that are merging. Thanks so much for being with us today, Greg.
Yeah, thank you. Bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and then turn you over to King John here in just a bit on 720 WGN.